Hello, I'm your host, Aaron Rittmaster. Welcome to the Man Cave, where joining me tonight to record Diz Dad's podcast number 378 for Sunday, March 6th, 2016, are Kevin Crossman.
Howdy, howdy.
Richard Grady.
Hello, everyone.
And Patrick Mines.
Good evening.
Now, tonight, we're going to be focusing a bit more on the dad side than the Disney side as we discuss the whys and hows of Family Game Night. But before we get to that discussion, I'd like to take a moment to remind you that the Diz Dads podcast is sponsored by Fantastic Memories Travel and its Mousemaster Travel Group. The Mousemaster Travel Group focuses on Disney destination vacations, and Mousemaster agents would love to take care of the stressful parts of vacation planning so you can focus on the fun. You can check us out at mousemastertravel.com. So the question that really got this all started is, you know, why do a family game night? And I guess I should back up one step and say, you know, I get ideas for show topics from maybe three or four different kind of broadly speaking areas. You know, some things I just come up with on my own. Some things people have suggested on one of the Diz Dads, you know, on the website, on the boards, in the chat room, something like that. And then every once in a while, we get things that somebody just pipes up and says, you know, we really ought to do a show on. And this one kind of falls in between two and three, because I had asked for suggestions for topics, and this one popped up. And so I thought, sure, that sounds great. And it does take us a little bit, sort of a half step, as I said, away from talking really focused on Disney, but it definitely has resonance as a dad. And as a, I think we found that there's some common ground, really, among a lot of us. So with that sort of long-winded introduction, I want to throw the question to the panel of, why do a family game night? And I'm going to start with, you know, one of our sort of hardcore gamer panelists, and ask Richard, you know, why do a family game night?
All right. So I should start with the disclaimer that we don't have a consistent family game night.
Sure.
You know, we try and do it. It shows up a lot more around the holidays, especially like, Christmas or Easter when you've got kind of the extended family. And so, you know, we'll play a lot more board games just because there's a lot more people around. A lot of games, you know, work better with five or six or seven people than with like three or four. And that's just kind of the way it goes.
Right.
The reason we have it is obviously it's family time. It's family time that's not plugged into the computer or watching TV or a movie or you know, playing Xbox or something. It's old school, old fashioned home entertainment kind of thing. You know, it is kind of an older, more traditional activity for a family to do. I think it's good for kids to play because they can see somebody else losing and not throwing a fit. Well, no, right. Like a lot of little kids, learning to lose is kind of a necessary skill.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when my kids were little and they would lose at Candyland or something, they'd rage flip the board and go stomping off. But they watch me play a game with, you know, my wife and brother-in-law and sister-in-law and things like that. I lost, you guys can keep playing because I'm out of the game, but the game's not over yet.
Right, right.
And, my kids are like, well, Dad, you lost. Aren't you mad? I mean, well, I'm a little upset. Sure, winning is fun, but I still had fun playing the game.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think there's absolutely important lessons that kids learn, not even from the game itself, but from the process, from playing and from participating.
Right. You gain all sorts of negotiation skills on some games. I've said that a lot of the games that I played as a kid taught me probability and math. You know, you start counting like, all right, I need a 7 or a 9 to get to here or hero monopoly, but if I get a 2 through 6, I'm done. You know, you start thinking about what are your odds here.
Okay, yeah.
And so
it's definitely some of that.
Or, you know, Yahtzee was another one where, you know, okay, well, if I can scoop the dice and re-roll everything, or I can keep what I've got and hope to make it into something good. So you start learning those kind of lessons, just thinking two or three or four steps ahead of where you're at, games tend to be kind of specific that here are the rules and this is the way we're going to follow them because it makes the game fair for everybody. You know, it's all of those little life lessons that I think games provide that you don't find in either, you know, watching a movie, you're not going to get them. Maybe you can pull them from the movie and talk about it, but it's not as obvious.
It's not as interactive. To the extent that kids get that kind of thing at all, it's only sort of, gotten by osmosis, right?
Right.
By observation. It's not an involved thing.
Right. And if they can get some of the same lessons playing a video game, but the game engine for Monopoly is open. It's obvious. Here are the rules. Here's how everything works. I can walk through the probabilities of all the dice with you if you want. You know, you're playing Halo, and my son is at the point where he kicks my butt at that pretty regularly now. The game engine is hidden.
Right.
You know, there's large parts of it going on that I really can't see. I just have to take it for granted that everything is fair and above board, and that, you know, he set up the game board in such a way that neither of us has an advantage. But you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that you can't see. And so if you get mad at it, you can't. No one can point you to it and say, well, this is what the rules say. Why do you think it says this? You know, you miss all that stuff, too.
Right, right. All right, so let me turn to Patrick and say, anything you want to add to Richard's take on, you know, why do family game night?
Well, sure. I remember growing up, almost every single family function, the cards were broken out. Some sort of game was being played when there was Uno or Hearts or War. I remember one time my grandpa's cousin, a teenager from Sweden, came to visit us for a couple weeks. And I was 5 years old at the time, and she and I bonded over checkers. You know, and that's cross-cultural, and cross-generational, and it's something we enjoy doing. Getting together, sitting down with your family, you're talking to each other, not only about the game, but, you know, or surrounding games. It's, you know, our family, we don't really sit at the table and eat dinner. My wife works nights, and you know, so sometimes it's just me and the kids, you know, when the in-laws come visit, you know, it's a time for all of us to sit down and enjoy something together as a family. Take a break, leave the TV in the other room, leave all the other distractions in the other room, and just sit down and enjoy each other's company and have a good time doing it, too.
That's a really great point. I mean, that piece about sort of the socialization that happens among the family during game night that has nothing to do with the game is really important. It gives everybody in the family kind of an opportunity to communicate on fairly equal footing. It's not mom and dad sort of leading a conversation. It's not the kids, you know, having to tell a story about something that happened at school or something like that. Some of that happens, but it's organic conversation, which I think we don't give ourselves enough opportunities for. How about you, Kevin? What else would you add about the value of a family game night?
Well, I would say that in terms of philosophy or life lessons or any of the other best practices that have been already talked about, I don't know if I can really add too much there. I think the other gentlemen have explained it, given a good take on it. I think for me personally, we're definitely not a family that is rigorous within this. And so maybe I'll get some good tips on how to maybe do that better in my own family. And then when we get to talk about some recommendations, I do have some for that. So,
Yeah, I mean, I would put myself sort of in the same category there as you, Kevin. I mean, I think that I grew up playing games a lot. I had two brothers, and I was the oldest of the three of us. So by the time my brothers were, you know, old enough and capable of playing games, I mean, the three of us naturally, family game night happened because there were three of us and we were doing stuff together, and it sort of, you know, evolved kind of because it, you know, was normal. Like, the majority of the house was already playing a game, so if my parents got involved, it became family game night. and it was before the days of ubiquitous video screens. So it happened a little more organically, and I'm kind of in Kevin's shoes where, you know, we do try to do game night occasionally, and we try and schedule it because, you know, we're all busy and doing 9 million things at once, and we try and use family game night as a night to say, okay, we're going to put the brakes on, you know, we're going to put everything aside, we're going to know it's coming, so you're not going to have homework that has to get done that night so you can focus on the family time, we're not going to be on the screens, and it's just going to be this time set aside for some family time that, you know, for folks who take vacationing seriously like we do, I think sometimes we don't do such a great job of taking care of our family time outside of vacation time. All right, so now we get to the part that for me, I think, is the challenge, right? Because I've got a now 13-year-old and a 9-year-old. And so I've got kids that are kind of in very different places in terms of the kinds of games that they can handle that, you know, work with them. Now, it's a little better now that my son has gotten older. So I want to start and kind of go break this down by age group and get some feedback from our, you know, game-playing folks here with some recommendations of games that work with different age groups. And I want to start with what is probably the hardest one, and this is the one that really was challenging for me, and that is games that work with those kids who are in that pre-reader stage. A lot of games really don't work if the participants aren't reading yet. So, Patrick, I think you've got the youngest kids of the group here. What kinds of games can you do a family game night with those kids that are not yet readers?
Well, I am under the philosophy that don't go by what the game says. You know your kids. You should know what they're capable of in terms of understanding concepts and whatnot. When I got into the hobby, back into the hobby, you know, really seriously, my oldest daughter was 5. And I knew that she was going to want to play these games with me because she's always been interested in a lot of the things that I do. And so I gently introduced her into some games. Like, she's 8 now, and she's played Settlers of Catan with adults and has beaten us, legitimately beaten us. We even had a chance to play with a former world champion, and she did fairly well in that game. But I mean, and my youngest is 3 now, and she enjoys, you know, she doesn't play like herself. Just getting into some of the games that we play, we let her, you know, have fun rolling the dice and whatnot. So, you know, even if they can't take an active role in the game, they still can take part in it. And like for my youngest, she's, you know, really keen on that. It worked for my 3-year-old. First of all, no Candyland. Please, please, please do not buy your children Candyland. It is a set of rules with a candy coating. It is not a board game. If you want something that approximates Candyland, my advice would be a game called Sneaky Snacky Squirrel.
Sneaky Snacky Squirrel.
Okay. Sneaky Snacky Squirrel. Basically, you are trying to collect acorns, 5 different acorns of different colors, and it's all based in a spinner, and that's what gets me about Candyland, is that there's no game there. It's you shuffle a deck of cards, and as soon as you pick the first player, the outcome is already determined. And there's nothing there other than teaching how to match colors.
They can learn not to cheat too.
Well, you can do that with any game, though.
My son was notorious for flipping through cards until he found what he liked and playing it.
You know, I think the frozen version of Candyland, I think, has a spinner. So that, you know, does a little bit different. But in any case, Sneaky Snacky Squirrel has a spinner. You spin it to see what color acorn you get. You can, it also has opportunity to steal acorns from players. You can take more than one acorn. So there's strategy involved. There's luck involved. There's a little grabber, squirrel-shaped grabber. So there's on in this game than just flipping a card and then moving to that color. There's also a game that the kids really enjoy called Feed the Kitty, which you're basically feeding mouse to a cat. You roll the dice and either saving mice or you're giving mice to the cat or you're giving mice to the opponent. And the first person to lose all their mice is the loser. And there's a game called Hiss where you're matching colors to try to build the longest snake. All these are color matching games. They all do what Candyland does, but so much better. And the theme is a lot more enjoyable too, I think, in all three of those games.
And it sounds like they add another layer so that, you know, when the kids first start playing out, it may actually play out much like Candyland, when, you know, they don't quite have a handle on the whole concept of the strategy pieces yet, but the strategy pieces are there for them to kind of grow into.
Right, right. Also, there's another game that we have called ABC, B as in the insect, which is kind of like a Yahtzee-based dice game where you're rolling letters and you're trying to match them to three-letter words on these cards, like car and cat and hat and B. And so my three-year-old is learning her letters now, and that's a really good game that she's really excited because you've got that tactile thing of rolling the dice and you're trying to collect these cards. The first one to collect five cards gets the card or is the winner. And it's really good for learning not only letters, matching the letters, but also, you know, as they start moving into learning how to spell, simple words to spell.
Sure, sure. So, Richard, any good pre-reader games you'd like to add to the discussion here?
Well, the Disney Princess Candyland is called Surprise Sliders, and I know this because we have a copy of it, actually.
Okay.
So I kind of went with a different tack on some of the things. My kids learned to play Uno fairly quickly. You know, we started out, just think color. That's all you had to do was worry about matching the color, because then you only have to have the four, and we took like the wild cards out and did some other things to make it simpler.
Right, right.
But once they know their numbers, at least to recognize them, even if they can't always tell which is the three and which is the eight, as long as it looks the same, then okay, I either have to match this color or this shape.
Right. You know, yeah,
we'd start playing it that way.
Matching game.
Exactly. We did a lot of matching games. Either we turned, you know, Uno into a matching game, or specifically a, you know, this animal matching game. So you'd have to flip over and look for two giraffes and things like that.
Right, right. There are plenty of simple versions of those matching games that you don't even have to, you know, buy special cards for, right? I mean, you can take a deck of cards and play Crazy Eights, or you can, you know, play Memory. And it's the same kinds of gaming skills and the same kinds of gaming activity, but it's maybe a little less expensive to get started with. And then once you got your kids hooked, then it's worth maybe spending a little money on some things that'll keep their interest in longer, or maybe give them the opportunity to develop some of these other game playing skills.
There's also the old Milton Bradley Cootie game where you're rolling a die and you're trying to assemble a bug.
Right.
You roll, I get to put antenna on my bug this turn. And again, it's a very simple game. It's one I played as a kid. Our kids played it a couple times, but I didn't have a full copy. It was a garage sale copy, I think, that I picked up, and enough pieces that they could see how it played. And he's just like, yeah, well, okay, fine. It didn't interest them. So
I loved that game when I was a kid.
Yeah, I played that game a lot, and we would make these weird hybrid bugs that were like six body sections long. You know, but for one reason or another, my kids just didn't care. Another one that
Milton Bradley did a whole series of those kinds of games, right?
Judy and Break the Ice and Ants in Their Pants, and
well, even Mousetrap is really essentially the same kind of game where the gameplay involves assembling something.
Yeah, and it's usually a luck-based game. You're taking turns. And the nice thing about a lot of the luck-based games is, you know, adults win that on some of the times, obviously. But it's not a case of the kid is outplayed. You know, there's nothing that the kid, in some ways, there's nothing the child could have done. It's, well, that's the dice said this one's done. Let's play it again. Or, well, okay, let's pretend that didn't happen and you didn't roll, You know your kid, and some 3-year-olds take losing with grace. Some of them don't. It's the way it goes. One of the games that I found a few years back, and it was just about the point where my daughter was learning to read, was called Ella Minis. And it's a card-based game. You have 5 different elements. There's earth, air, fire, water, and trees. And you're trying to have one of each of those in front of you. And there's also a trash, and there are a couple of other things. You draw one card per turn, and you have to play it. But you can play it on yourself, or you can play it on somebody else. And so when you're playing with adults, it's, okay, I've got a tree, and I pull the water. Well, I can use the water, but I can use the water to put out your fire. So I'm going to do that. You start playing against each other, trying to make sure no one wins. But with kids, it's just they want to get one of each in front of them, and so you can help them. Because, oh, I've already got a tree. I can't use it. Well, I have to put it in front of you. So it's a good game that, as an adult, you can kind of make sure the kid wins without it being obvious.
You can manipulate it within the confines of the game itself.
Right. They can win without being, obviously winning with your help. They're not going to realize that you're helping them win. But they can also still lose. It can change fairly quickly, et cetera. But it's not it's like an introduction to probability and card games and playing against each other. Right. But it can be made very, very easy to help them win if they're not doing well.
Okay. That sounds great.
And then dominoes, because it's a pattern matching, same kind of thing. Uh-huh. But a young child can learn dominoes even before they can count, just because they're matching the pattern of the dots.
Right. Yeah. So, Kevin, how about you? Any others that you want to add to the good games for pre-readers? I know it's been a while since your kids were pre-readers.
Yeah, it's too far for my brain. But I would say I took a look. That squirrel in that game looks so cute. I might have to buy it anyway.
It's a devious game, man. You get the spinner going, and the wind comes and blows all your acorns away, and you could just get crushed, I'll tell you.
Yeah, now the only thing I would add is that a couple of games that have worked well for us are some games that are maybe a little more tactile. I live in a household of people with ADHD, every single one of us. So games that are a little tactile are, I think, really helpful for us, especially to start the night out with, because once you get everybody kind of committed to it and into it, it goes a little more smoothly. You can kind of ease into some other games, but games that are not so much in your head and sort of waiting your turn to roll dice kind of work better for us in that pre-reader stage. So things like Jenga is a great game for that kind of thing, because it's you still have to wait your turn, but it's not multi-step, right? When it gets to be your turn, you get to act. So Jenga, similarly, games like Pickup Sticks or the other game that uses the Pickup Sticks, the name I can't remember. The one that...
Kerplunk.
Huh? Yeah. Kerplunk, where there's
Kerplunk, that's the one.
With all the marbles and you're pulling the sticks out. Yeah.
Yeah. And so those are games that you don't have to be able to read for. They, you know, in both cases, you get at least the beginnings of developing some strategy skills, right? Because you're thinking not just what piece can I remove and not lose, but what piece can I remove that makes it hard for the next person? And it kind of adapts naturally as they play. So I think that those games are good for those pre-readers, especially who, you know, a lot of games, you're kind of limited, right? You can do manipulative games like that. You can do matching games, and you can do situations where the one who's not reading yet is sort of teamed with someone who does read. But it's an alternative to a more card-based game. All right, so let's move to the next kind of age grouping, which is a little broader and you get some more flexibility. And that would be that sort of preteen group, right? Your elementary through sort of middle schoolish age kids that they can read now. You can do just about anything with them. But what are some really great engaging family games that you can do with that age group? And Kevin, this is a little closer to you, so I'll let you get us rolling with these.
All right, so I've got a couple here. One of the ones that I enjoyed playing with my son when he was in this age group was the Scrambled States of America game. This is based on the children's book about states that are trying to, you know, move around, and they you know, I want to go to the East Coast, but I'm California, so the states don't work together, right? They have to go back to the original spots.
Right.
So the game is kind of fun because it works on a couple different levels, because if you're a fan of the book, they're the same graphics and images and stuff like that. But then it has like these little challenges. So find a state that's touching Tennessee, or find a state that's west of the Mississippi, or find a state with no E in its capital. And you have these cards, and you can kind of, you know, play the game, and you try to return the states back to where they're supposed to go. Lots of fun for, you know, this under 10 age group, and, you know, maybe educational about our country and all that business, too.
It's nice when you can kind of fake them into learning something, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Sort of the traditional old school Epcot.
Yes. So, and speaking of Epcot, my next choice has a tie-in there of sorts. The go-to game that we have whenever we've got Christmas or anything like that, we pull out the old Heads Up game on the iPhone, and you know this has been promoted by Ellen DeGeneres, stupid Junie, stupid energy, but you know it's a lot of fun. It's a lot like the $20,000 pyramid. So you have something, and it's a clue, and it's in different categories like movies, and you have a clue that's, you know, Titanic, and you have to say, well, it was a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and a big ship that sank. Titanic, correct. And then you move on to the next one.
Okay.
And so it's a lot of fun like that, and they have these different decks, some of which are free and some of which you can pay for, that are on different themes. And one of the updates that just came out this last few weeks was that they have an update. And you can now get Disney Parks as your one of the decks.
Oh, cool!
So now, just like the Disneyland 60th anniversary, this really is less about the parks and more about Disney in general. So yes, you see Frontierland or Space Mountain, but then you see Mulan and, you know, Mickey and Minnie and all the different characters, and it's just generic Disney stuff. And yes, they're in the parks, but you know what I mean? It's not specific to a park to say, right, you know, right. Mulan or something like that. So anyway, Heads Up is a game that's really enjoyable and lots of fun for kids of all ages, as they say.
All right. Sounds good. Sounds good. So that got us started, got us a little Disney theme action in there as well. So Patrick, what are some games that you would recommend for this kind of in-between age? And for me, the challenge with this age, right, is that they can read, they're capable of playing these games, but some of the games that involve either more complicated wordplay or are sort of trivia or quiz-based games put the kids at sort of an unfair disadvantage, because they just don't have they haven't developed the vocabulary, or they don't have the just sort of, you know, cultural vocabulary based on experience yet
right.
to compete in some of those kinds of games.
Yeah, I mean, we've got all the Disney trivia games and Disney Seen It and whatnot. And, you know, either my wife or I dominating, even when we're, quote unquote, taking it easy. So we kind of stay away from those. But we found a couple that my 8-year-old really, really liked and really excels at. Well, like I said, you know, Catan, she develops her own little strategy and she just runs with it. There's a version called Catan Junior, which is heavily pirate themed. And I try to stay away from junior version of games because they just seem way too dumbed down,
uh-huh.
way too simplified. And it just doesn't seem fun for the adult to play with. Oh, great. And he wants to play Monopoly Junior. All right, we'll sit down for
that one in particular because my kids picked that one up because there was I'm drawing a blank. It was some Disney property themed version of Monopoly Junior, and for the life of me, I can't remember which property it was. But my God, that game was difficult to just make yourself play.
Right.
It's not the same game.
Right, but. Catan Jr. it was a pirate theme to it, and it actually is quite enjoyable as a kid's game, and for adults to play too. You know, it's not like you're suffering through a horribly simple game. There's still a lot of luck based in it, and there's still the trading aspect of it from the more adult version of it. But there's a lot going on with it that makes it a lot of fun. Another one that's really enjoyed in our household is called Word on the Street. There is a junior version of this too, which I would recommend for kids. The difference between the two is the difficulty of the questions, but also the adult version. Well, the basics of the game is you've got all these letters down the middle of a highway, and you pull a card and it says a word. You have to come up with a word that describes the subject on the card. So a type of fruit. Oh, banana. So you would move the B to your side, the A to your side, the N to your side, the A to your side another time, and you try to move the letters off the street to your side, and then you score those letters.
Interesting.
The adult version doesn't have the vowels in it. So no A, E, I, O, U, which, you know, if your kid is starting to learn to spell, that could be kind of difficult. So in that case, I would, you know, get the junior version of that. But that's a fun game that can go a lot of way. You know, if, depending on the words you use, you can score really big. You know, your opponent gets a turn, they move the letters back to their side. So it's kind of like a tug of war with those letters.
Sure.
Quirkle is another game that would also work for a younger crowd. It's a tile laying game where you're matching colors and shapes. And you're trying to get six in a row, either of the same color or of the six different shapes. And then you score based on that. And that's another one that, you know, the whole family can enjoy together. And then also cooperative games is another one where it's you're not playing against each other. You're playing against the game. And with those kind of games, you can help the kids with the game. So you can help them work on their strategies. You can help them without letting them win, basically.
Right, because that's within the game. That's the way it's supposed to go, is that you're supposed to collaborate.
And one game that I would recommend for a younger crowd, in fact, I would recommend this for anyone interested in getting into a tabletop as a hobby. A lot of the games nowadays are really expensive. They're like brand new video game or higher expensive. You're looking $40, $50 per game.
Right, right.
So not looking, you know, you really want to know what you're getting into. but there's a game called Forbidden Island that is a really solid four-player game. It's a cooperative game. You're going around, you're collecting cards, trying to match a set of cards to get a trophy, and you collect all four trophies before the island sinks. And it's on a timer where you're flipping cards, and all of a sudden, all the islands start sinking. And these cards you got to flip over, and you got to get back to the helicopter pad before it sinks and get off the island. It's a really fun game, really intense game that you can adjust the difficulty level. If you're playing with adults, you can make it harder. If you're playing with younger kids or new people, you can make it really easy. Best part of all, it's like $18, and it is a really, really solid game with really nice components. I can't believe that's the base price is $18. I would recommend that all day and all night.
That sounds like an interesting one.
It's a good game.
And I think that collaborative games with this age group are particularly useful, because I think that this is the pre-adolescent, right? That competitive streak has developed at this point, and sometimes, especially among family and involving, you know, brothers and sisters, collaborative is really the way to go. You know, playing a highly competitive game, you're rolling the dice a little bit, right? Because on the one hand, you want to teach them these lessons about winning gracefully and losing gracefully, but at the same time, you can play one round of a really competitive game and then have it blow up in your face. Or you can, if nothing else, warm up with a more collaborative experience. And then once you've got everybody committed to it, move on to a more competitive game and maybe be able to, enjoy that game a little bit more rather than have it be quite so contentious.
Right.
All right, so Richard, do you have some suggestions for us for this kind of preteen group?
Yeah, so for like the younger age, I included things like checkers or Connect Four, just because they're easy games to learn, but they can actually be much harder to master. There's an older game called Othello, which is just black and white discs. And it's a case of I place this black disc here, and everything between this black disc and that one, I flip all the whites.
Right, and which oddly enough is a really great game for modern preteens, because the way the game works is very similar to a lot of the screen-based video games that they play. Right,
yeah.
A lot of those games have that same connect the chain kind of thing mechanism.
Right, and it's a very simple game to learn, and again, you can, as an adult, you can choose suboptimum moves to help the kid, you know, prolong the game, give them a chance to win and whatnot. But they're also very, very hard games to do well. So yes. The kids aren't going to play it and master it in like 3 weeks and never want to play it again. Yeah, you know, I haven't played Othello in a couple of years, but I would love to play it again. Because it's still a good game.
Right, and it's still a challenging game. Like, it's
right.
Not a game where you can figure out the trick and then it's over.
Right. I put in, like, Clue and Battleship as well. Again, it's kind of the classic game. They're still playable. There's a repeat play value. You can play Battleship again and again and again, but it's a two-person game.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing around that.
Right.
I did include the fantasy flight game Star Wars X-Wing for this age group.
Okay.
Okay, so the problem, and Moise, this is bad, because your base game for this one runs you about $30 to $35. It'll come with one X-Wing and two TIE fighters. You can expand on it by buying more X-Wings and more TIE fighters and
okay.
A-Wings
so
and
B-Wings.
These are
the miniature-based games.
Yes, this is a miniature-based. It's not really a board game in a classic sense. You can play it on a kitchen table, though. So it's kind of this fine line. It's not really a miniatures game quite. It's like a miniatures game light, and it's still kind of board gamey in a lot of ways.
Okay.
But it's a good one. It's got repeat play value. If your kids like Star Wars, you know, you can play it again and again. The kind of nice thing I have found with it is, like, I have my ships, but my you know, my son has kind of a couple that he wants. And so maybe the next time we go to the store, it might be a, hey, did you like Kylo Ren's Interceptor? Well, they've got it, you know.
Oh, okay. So, and sort of similar to the way that some of the Disney Infinity characters have become sort of collectibles, it's that kind of collectible nature, but also playable.
Right. And you get to see what you're getting. There's none of the, you know, it's not like the Magic card game or the collectible miniatures game that were really popular about 10 or 15 years ago, where it's a booster box and don't know what's in it. This is I want that A-Wing and I buy that A-Wing and I know what comes with it.
Yeah.
But the downside is if you're not careful, it's just like Disney Infinity. You turn around and go, how did I collect...
And did I really want $150 Star Wars miniatures
game? 37 ships? Oh, gee. Yeah. I don't want to think about what I spent on them. I'll just pretend that I got them for free.
That's exactly why I've never picked that game up, because I know I would be more broke than I already am.
It's a fun game. Fortunately, I picked up a couple copies of the base game at a half-off sale, and I've picked up some of the other miniatures, you know, at a Christmas sale and this sale and that sale. So I haven't spent too much on it, but it's also not my main game. If it were, I'd be a lot more broke than, you know, again, I could easily dump $400 into the game and go, look at all the ships I've got. And
yeah,
some of them I wouldn't use very often.
This is a good example of a know your kid thing, because that game, you know, I think we would really struggle with that in our house because my son's a completist.
And if you've got to have them all, that's going to be a problem with this one.
Yeah.
I had Forbidden Island on there as well, because it's a fun game. I've got my copy. A very portable game that my kids have liked in the last year or so, and that I've enjoyed for a few years, is Flux. Flux is a card game. It's very, very simple. At the base of the game, every player starts with 3 cards. You will draw one, and you will play one. But the cards you draw are going to be new rules, so you can change how many cards you draw, how many you play, how many cards you can have in your hand, all that kind of stuff. That changes from turn to turn, player to player. There are also goal cards that you have to be played before anyone can win. And they will say things like death by chocolate. And if someone has the 2 keeper cards, chocolate and death, played in front of them, and that the goal is death by chocolate, that player wins, even if it's not you.
Right.
And then there are action cards.
I'm
glad
you bring up this game, because I have to mention that this is, as I just said, this is a know your kids game. I totally blew it with Flux. I saw the game, fell in love with it, thought this is really great. It reminded me a lot of a game that I played a lot in high school and college, called Cosmic Encounters.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cleaner version of Cosmic, right? It was a little more straightforward. My kids, it drives them crazy, because they want to know what the rules of the game are. And because the rules of the game are constantly changing, it just makes them mad.
Yeah, I've learned as a player, I don't pay attention to any of the rules when it's not my turn.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to – I don't care what it says 2 people before me or what the person after me does. It doesn't matter, because –
it's going to change by the time it gets to you anyway.
It will change. It better change. If it doesn't, I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about Flux is there's, 10 or 15 different versions. There's Holiday Flux and Eco Flux and Zombie Flux and Pirate Flux and Space Flux. There's a bunch of them. And so know your kids. You know, we hauled out the Holiday Flux at Christmas time, and the kids loved it because they could play holiday themed Flux.
Yeah. Yeah. And as long as your kids are into it, the beauty of a game like that is that it's infinitely repeatable, because every version is going to be different and every game is going to be different just by nature of the game.
Right. And the game tends to be quick. So it's something you can haul out and play a couple games in 20 or 30 minutes and then put it away. It doesn't take a whole lot of space. It's a deck of cards, more or less.
Sure.
My wife is a Flux addict. We have every single version of Flux.
I have 5, I think. I can't see from here. I can only see 3 of them. But do you have Cthulhu Flux yet?
I think that one and Martian Flux are the 2 that we don't have.
I picked up Cthulhu Flux.
She's, she's correcting me as I'm looking over there.
I picked up Cthulhu Flux at Gen Con a couple years back. I put Meal Born on there as well as a card game.
That's another one that's kind of a classic. But
it is, and it's something I played a lot as a kid. It's very repeatable. It doesn't take up a whole lot of space. It's multiplayer. The basic objective is you have cards in your hand, you're laying out mileage, and you're trying to complete 1,000 miles.
Right.
But there are things like flat tire.
Basically, you're trying to add up to 1,000.
Yep. And so but everything's even. You know, it's 25, 50, 7,500. I think there's a 125. It's been a long time since I played. But it's you know, all by five, so it's pretty easy to add up. There's cards you can play on other players, cards you know, play it on yourself. And so it's competitive, but again, it's a lot of luck, and it's very repeatable.
What's the name of that one?
Meal Born. MILLESBOURNES. It's French.
I think that's one that Milton Bradley, you know, publishes now, but it's a card game. I mean, it's probably even out of copyright at this point.
I played that as a kid. And there's a local little game store near us, and I went in there the other day, and they had that and a couple of other games. And I didn't pick it up, but it was one of those, oh, I could get this and this and this. It certainly went onto the list. Well, no, I figured it was something I was going to have to eBay for, but seeing that it's still in print, and it's like $15. So it's certainly a really good value.
Right.
Let's see. Was there anything else on there? I had Catan on there as well, just because it's a really good game. There's another game by, I think it's Asmodee, called Timeline, that I haven't picked up yet. So I haven't played it, but it looks really promising. The basic idea is you're playing cards, and it's a where did this card fit historically against the other cards that have already been played. So say I play that the first card is Elvis Sings Blue Suede Shoes, and the card I have is the moon landing. Well, which came first?
Okay.
Is the moon landing after Blue Suede or before Blue Suede? And so apparently, again, there's like four or five versions of this, but I got told that kids do really well at like the American history version and a couple of the others, simply because they're still studying that in school.
Right. It's current for them. And when you've got to do it, you're reaching back.
Yeah. So it's like, well, I kind of remember when these big events happened, but after that, it gets kind of fuzzy. So, but again, it's card game, doesn't take much space, doesn't need a whole lot of space on a table to play, multiplayer, repeatable game. And that's kind of what I'm looking for with a lot of my kids' stuff right now, is that it's got to be repeatable, and it's got to be kind of cheap, so that I don't want to sink, you know, $50, $60, or $100 for some of these into a game and find out that my kids hate it. Yeah. I mean, 15 I can do, and 20 I'll do, but I'd hate for some of the games I bought thinking, oh, I really hope. I picked up Rum and Bones on the Kickstarter. And I did not get it, hoping my kids would play it. I got it because I wanted to play it.
Right.
And I wasn't about to drop that kind of money on hoping my kids will play it.
So let's go kind of throw the floor open and talk about maybe just a few good examples of games. And you know, I started to say, well, we can talk about, you know, games that you would play with teens. But here's the reality. Once they're teenagers, you can play anything with them. You could play with other adults. The real challenge, though, is that with, you know, a few exceptions, I think one of the hardest sort of transitions is when you've got, you know, two or three kids in the family, you've got one teen, and the other kids are still younger, and they're not quite ready for those, you know, fully adult game experiences. Some are, some aren't, you know, but you've got a mix there. And so, anybody have any good suggestions for games that work well sort of across the age spectrum? You know, not necessarily the simplest games, but sort of that next level of games that are still going to be engaging and that the teens aren't going to complain are boring games. but that the younger kids are still going to be able to play and enjoy?
I can think of a couple.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll let you go first. I'm sure we're thinking a lot of the same way.
So for the first one, I need to issue a disclaimer. I'm a press ganger for a company called Privateer Press. They do mostly miniatures games. In the last couple of years, they've branched out into board games.
Okay.
And keep that in mind. I'm not saying this because I'm obligated to. This is actually one of those where I've really enjoyed it.
Right.
It's called Zombies Keep Out. And it's a cooperative 4-player game. Or 1-to-6-player game, sorry. For some reason, I was thinking 4. And I think it's just the last time we played it.
Sure.
Basically, you're a goblin. You're in the game for this. You're the goblins are the tinkerers, the builders, and you're trying to defend your home from a zombie horde. And what you're trying to do is collect the pieces to build weapons to kill the zombies.
Okay.
But it's a collaborative game, so I've got these cards in my hand. I'm going to do this on this turn, but I need you to do this on your turn, and you know, blah blah blah. So you can work with the younger players, help them learn.
Right.
The goblins only win about half the time, more or less. As you start to lose your hand options, what you can do with your hand gets more and more limited. And eventually, because when the zombies get you, they bite you. And as you've been bitten, the first time you're slurring your words. And once you've been bitten about 3 or 4 times, you can't play any cards. You go, and that's your turn. So,
okay. You know, so there's some fun sort of silly sort of game play involved, almost play acting involved.
Right, and it's silly and it's kind of whimsical, but it's cooperative. It's got zombies and it's over the top in some of the things. You know, there's like the something or other hydrostatic water pressure cannon of death or something. You know, just the names are ridiculous. So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of campy thing that the little kids will like and have them make sound effects and go wild with things like that. Because you might as well.
All right.
The other one that I would say that teens will like and they will enjoy, but it's still cooperative so younger players can play, is Pandemic. We haven't tried this.
You've gone with two death and disease type games.
Anyway. But I think when you wind up with the younger kids to the teens to the adults, you almost need to have a cooperative game or a team game where you've either got this team versus that team versus another or a cooperative. And of the cooperative ones that I have and I have played, it's Zombies Keep Out, and there are a couple other privateer ones, and then Pandemic. And Pandemic has been a big hit in our family. Just because it's when we haul it at Christmas, because you know what says a season of peace and brotherly love, like you know, trying to save the world from disease or having the bioterrorist option, which is all kinds of fun. But again, it's complicated enough that a teenager is going to enjoy it as a challenge, or can enjoy it as a challenge. But you can still, the younger players still have things to do because it's a Your characters are such and such. I need you to do these things on your turn. And on my turn, I can help you by doing this for you, and you can do this for me. So cooperative, I think, is the way I would look at this, or the way I would push for something when you've got young kids and teenagers.
Sure. All right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right. So Patrick, you thought you might have some suggestions for us for this kind of thing, too.
This is primarily what we do. When my in-laws come to visit, we have them and my wife and I and my eldest daughter, we all play games, and Pandemic is one of them that we do break out. It's basically an upgraded version of Forbidden Island. It's by the same designer. It's a little more difficult version. It's a little more sinister version of Forbidden Island. Based on that, also there's a cooperative game called Flashpoint, which you are playing firefighters saving people from a burning house before it gets overtaken with flames and gets destroyed. And that's another one that that my in-laws absolutely love and that my daughter really loves to play. Another game I would suggest is King of Tokyo, which is basically kind of a Yahtzee-ish type of game. You're rolling dice, you are giant monsters trying to take over the city of Tokyo, and you're battling it out based on what your dice roll. You can score, first person to score 20 victory points or knocks out all the other monsters win.
Yeah, that one reminds me of the Rampage video game.
Yep, just like that. And in fact, there's a Rampage game based on that video game too. It's more of a dexterity game, but that one looks fun too. But yeah, King of Tokyo, there can be a lot of strategy there, but it's also very quick and easy for the young ones to pick up. Also, Ticket to Ride. You're laying train tracks down to match different cities based on what tickets you have. And you do that by collecting cards of similar colors and then matching them to the routes between cities. And it's a really simple one for kids to pick up, but again, it's one that all ages can enjoy. And going back with the Flux games, those are been really popular with the multiple age groups too that I've seen. It's what group is like, and you know, if they're pretty easy going, you can go with the combative type games. If you know one's maybe a little more bloodthirsty than the rest, then maybe you want cooperative games to kind of keep that in check and let the younger ones not be so pressured.
Right. Yeah, and I think that it's good that you've got, you know, a balance too, because you don't want to do always the collaborative, but it's nice to have in the sort of bag of tricks as an alternative to the more hyper-competitive. I don't know, Kevin, you have any thoughts on the ideas of you know, sort of cross-age group games? I mean, I was even thinking of some of the very sort of basic and simple traditional games. I mean, things like even backgammon, right, which has straightforward rules that are fairly simple to follow, but you know, your skill level can develop over time, and it's something that I think works pretty well as long as the kids are old enough to be able to handle the counting. Then it works sort of across ages fairly well, because there's enough luck involved that it can keep somebody from getting, you know, totally wiped out by, you know, an older player's higher level of skill. But by the same token, there is enough skill involved that it's not going to feel too dumbed down for an older kid.
Yeah, I don't really have anything specific to add to this category, but I would note, just in defense of my earlier pick, when you use the heads up game, there's a lot of decks that are like video games and superheroes where sometimes the kids might have an advantage over the adults.
Oh, absolutely.
So there might be some options in games like that where you choosing a category or whatever might be a way to give kids even the actual advantage. So.
Right. I mean, that's a good point that, you know, don't assume that just because it is a quiz-based game or a question-and-answer type game that, you know, the kids are going to be at a disadvantage. And that's really true even of games like Apples to Apples, which, as long as the kids can read and write, they can generally compete. Now, there is a junior version. I don't know that the junior version, I mean, I guess the only thing it does is that the junior version maybe, you know, stays out of some topical areas that maybe are a little harder for kids to react to. But, you know, that's a game that, because the judge is a player in the game, you know, the kids get a chance to be the judge too. And as a result, it sort of balances things out a little bit, right? I mean, the adult giving a more sophisticated answer isn't necessarily the better answer if it's got to be the answer that's chosen by whoever the judge is, because if the judge doesn't get it, the judge isn't going to pick it.
Yeah, and the only reason we don't play Apples to Apples as often as we do is it's one that it's, I find that it doesn't work as well when you've only got three or four players that it does. It really starts to shine at five or six.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, so it's one that unfortunately, because we have several editions of, or several versions of Apples to Apples, it just doesn't get played that often.
Yeah, and it's definitely better with the more I think that's a good example of a game that, that almost the more people you have, the better it gets.
Yeah, I don't think Apples to Apples will break down until you hit about 10 or 12 people.
Right.
And even then it might not. I'd actually have to try it, but I think you could handle 10.
The problem with it at that many people is it just gets difficult to, it almost gets too difficult to judge, right? I mean, when it's a kid's turn to judge and they've got to choose from among, you know, 10 or 12 answers, it starts to get harder.
Yeah.
But I think that's a great example of a game that scales really well for extended family, right? If you've got everybody together for Thanksgiving or something and you're looking for something to keep everybody kind of engaged together, you know, that's something that'll work well. Where some other games, you know, backgammon or even a four-person card game, right, it inherently exclude a bunch of people. All right, well, we've talked through different categories. Any games that didn't necessarily fit into one of the niches we mentioned, but it's something that you enjoy and that you your family enjoys doing together that you want to suggest that people consider?
Yeah, I've got a couple here. You know, we talked earlier about some of the branded versions of these games, and sometimes those aren't always so awesome. But I would say for a game like Monopoly, that sometimes the branded versions, the Star Wars version or whatever, sometimes can be a little bit more... kids may, and even adults may have more of a time thinking about the planets in this group as opposed to Baltic Avenue. Like, what's that? I don't know. So I would say if, you know, and I think Monopoly's even in our family, still a very popular game. We just play a, you know, a branded version. If you're looking for a card game, I think Hearts is a really good game. You know, you have to play with four, you know, three or four. Four is better. And while it is an individual game, there is some opportunities for cooperative situations if people are trying to shoot the moon or whatever. Sure. The other players have to work together a little bit to stop it. So I think that's a fun game. And I'll give you guys a tip. We played a variant of Hearts in college called Hearts for Shots. Does anybody want to guess what the variant was?
My guess is that you try to lose that you drink.
No, in fact, I set you guys up. So the shots in this case were every time you took a point at the end, you know, at the end of each game. If I had 8 points that round, somebody in the game could give me 8 shots in the arm or in the leg or whatever. So you know, boys in dorms. So they give you an extra incentive.
It's a more violent version of the game than I think would be go over well in my family.
But I'm telling you, you know, sometimes you think, well, should I shoot the moon or not? Well, you know, you better make sure you get it. Otherwise, you're taking 25 shots or something like that. You know, it's not very fun. So those are the two, I guess, for me in that category.
Yeah,
I have one more.
Sure.
If you don't mind a little black humor, and it sounds like that's not a problem with some of the other panelists here tonight, an old favorite card game, Nuclear War, and its various expansion packs. If you don't mind black humor, it's a lot of fun, really good game.
Skippy the Super Virus.
Yeah.
I would say it's not a bad idea to have a copy of According to Hoyle and a few decks of cards. Just because there are probably hundreds of card games out there, you know, aside from, you know, Hearts and Euchre and Poker and Whist and Cribbage and, you know, I really should have a copy. I used to, and I think I lost it in a move, but it's a good idea. You know, it's not a bad book to have.
Well, you know what? It's a great book to have, but there are websites that have a lot of this data. Now, a book, I think, is better because if the whole point of game night is you're trying to pull people away from the screen, the last thing you want to have to do is, you know, pull out the iPad so that you can look up the rules.
But it's not a bad idea to go online and see how it's played as opposed to read it. I can get that.
Right. Well, that too. And there's some value to that. And it's a little easier to search, too. But you know, that's a great point that there are a lot of these. Look, there's only so many ways that you can combine, you know, 52 cards, but there are lots of them.
Yeah. And then two other odd games that didn't quite fit any category. There's a card game called Boss Monster, where the artwork kind of replicates that old 16 and 32 bit like arcade games. So it's very pixelated and whatnot. You're the bad guy. You're the monster, and you are trying to build a dungeon. And so every turn you're playing out a dungeon card, and then based on the rating of your dungeon determines what heroes come into your dungeon for you to kill.
Interesting.
So you decide, yeah, my dungeon, I'm going to have sacks of gold to attract the thieves, and the thieves come in and they take damage from this trap, and then this room has monsters in it, in this room, and the thief is dead, and I gain that many points. Or the thief gets through this room and this room and this room and hits me, and I take this amount of damage. And so it's a fun, quirky kind of game. You can't take it too seriously.
Right. But it sounds like it would appeal to kids, for example, who are into Minecraft a lot, right? Because there are some of those kinds of similar elements built into it.
It's kind of a weird game. You could play it because it's an easy reader kind of game. It doesn't have a whole lot of words that they need to read. They don't need to read the flavor text on the card or anything like that. They can match symbols,
they can follow
sort of
pictograms.
However, the room of succubi, it's in there. I mean, it's they're pixelated and they're not. It's not worse than PG or thereabouts. But depending on how many questions you want to ask, answer from your kids, it's sure. There is kind of that. So it works with an easy reader, but like my son is 12 tomorrow, actually. Well, in like 4 hours, but he's old enough that he's asked these questions and he's gotten the answers.
Right.
My daughter is 9. She hasn't asked those questions. She would. So little A, little B. The other one, amazingly, it's a $4 game when you can find it. It's called Ogre by Steve Jackson Games.
All right. That's one that's been around a long time. It's kind of a Steve Jackson Games classic.
It is, and the reason it's $4 is when they released they did the Kickstarter for the deluxe edition of Ogre with the gorgeous cardstock counter or the 3D cardstock and all that. They said they were going to release the classic version for $4.
Ah, okay.
So it's
part of the deal for getting backers to back the Kickstarter.
Right, and so it went to stores, and you can find it for $4 in the Ziploc baggie, the way it used to be in the late 70s.
Right.
The neat thing about Ogre is one player gets one model, one little marker that's the ogre. And it's this big, heavily armored cyber tank that's the length of a football field with a really bad attitude and nuclear weapons. The other player gets a whole host of things to throw at it and try and stop it. So one player gets very used to, all right, my ogre moves forward 2 spaces and I kill these 4 things. And then the other player says, yes, but I've got these 27 different things to move at you and attack you. And most of them do very little damage, but, it'll add up over turns and turns and turns. My son loves this game because I backed the Kickstarter. So I have that huge, big, gorgeous card game with the cardstock minute, the 3D printed.
The 3D and all that.
And it's gorgeous. But I have the Ziploc game, too, and all the counters are cut. And that way I can take it with me because then you put it on a table and it's only it's a little bigger than an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper.
The map is really
small.
Case scenario: a couple of cards get kicked under a sofa in a hotel and you lose them. It's $4 to replace.
Yeah. I've lost it. The only downside to that is finding a game store that has it. You can't go into Walmart and pick one up. You're going to have to find an actual gaming store that stocks, probably role-playing games and miniature games and Magic and things like that.
Right. But hey, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right?
No, it's not. It's just
down.
It's harder to find if you're in a small town. Fortunately, there's Amazon and, the internet, and I'm sure you could find one that way too.
Sure.
Just pay $4 in shipping for it as well.
Any last thought games for us, Patrick? Things that didn't fit neatly into a category already, but you want to make sure to mention?
Yeah, there's three that I want to make a special note of. One is called Smash Up, It's a card-based game where you take these different factions like ghosts and zombies and dinosaurs and cybernetic monkeys and cowboys and pirates, and you take two different factions, and that's your deck. You mix them together, and so you have dinosaur robots or alien pirates, and those are your factions, and you're playing cards to try to take over bases and score points. It's a lot of fun. It's got a lot of great humor in it. There are a lot of different factions. The base game comes with, I think, 8, and there have been more expansions that have come out that added $4. I'm not one for expansions because a lot of times the expansions are as expensive as the game itself. But these are relatively decent price for expansions for the base game. Another game, the two other games I have are kind of more, a little more obscure. One's called Once Upon a Time. It's a storytelling game based on cards. You're dealt a hand of cards, and each one has like a word on it, like princess or happy, or stuff like that. And you start telling a story, and you play cards when they come up in your story. And you go back and forth with the other players. My daughter absolutely loves this, and we've come up with some very interesting stories with that. There's also a game that was kickstarted called Adventure Maximus. I'm surprised this one's not bigger than it is. Basically, it's role-playing game. If you want to get your kids interested in Dungeons & Dragons or Pathfinder or something like this, this would be a good starter for that. The dungeon master basically asks, you start the game off with a Mad Lib, and then you draw five cards, and that's your locations and your monsters and your treasure, and your character creation is also based on cards. You're dealt three cards, and you choose out of the three if you want to be a human, a dwarf, a foodkin, a goblin, a dragonkin, and what their specialty is. I had my game that I played with that. I was a foodkin archaeologist with an electric guitar weapon. I made him an ice cream cone. I called him Indiana Cones. and my daughter was a werewolf named Skippy, I think. And we just... It was a blast to play. It's quick and it's easy, and it's something that the kids that at the table that I played with, they really got into it. Adventure Maximus.
Interesting. That one sounds, again, a really good, it's a gateway game, right? It really does sort of give you a chance to feel out whether your kids are going to be into that kind of gaming, and gives them a flavor of it without, being quite so overwhelming as a completely open-ended role-playing game.
Right.
All right. Before we wrap up, I did want to go and just do kind of one quick round here of, those Disney-specific games that didn't come up yet in the conversation. In some cases, branded games that maybe, in some cases didn't work so well, but there are some that do, some that are fun, and I know that we are working here, we're talking to a community of Disney fans. So what are some suggestions of some Disney games that do work, that are fun to play for the family? And I know, Kevin, you've had one that you're kind of holding for us.
Yeah, so we love to play the Magic Kingdom game. Now, the idea of this game is that it's a Magic Kingdom style layout, but it's actually a mix of elements from the Magic Kingdom Park in Florida and Disneyland. So you have things like the Matterhorn, but also the Country Bears and that sort of thing. And so, and obviously some of the lands, which are not common, are blended a little bit. Okay. And the idea is that you get an attraction in one of each of the lands, and you have to go by rolling dice and moving along the little path to collect, go to each of those attractions and then get back out the turnstiles. But along the way, there are obstacles and players can force you to go to some other part of the board or whatever. And so it's, while it is a strategy in terms of what you do and how you do it, it's not like it's real complicated for even younger kids. I mean, they have to read a little bit, but even there's pictures on the cards and everything. So if you're looking for something that is Parks inspired, I think you do a lot worse than the Magic Kingdom game. It's a lot of fun.
That one sounds good.
That one you can find that one pretty easily at like yard sales and thrift stores and Goodwill for really cheap too. It's a great game.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to say, is that that's one that you probably need to look for on a secondary market, because I don't think it's being made anymore.
I don't believe it is.
Yeah, but do keep an eye out, because you can get it for a good deal, and as Kevin pointed out, it's a fun game, and it is one I think that is a good... that one I think is a good example of a game that can be sort of cross-age group compatible. Even though it's maybe, you know, a little bit simplistic gameplay for the older kids, you know, the fact that it's a familiar Disney park based game makes it a little more palatable. They're willing to play a little simpler game because it's fun to be able to you know, do the Disney parks piece of it. Anybody else have some suggestions of, you know, actual Disney themed games that are worthwhile?
There's the Disney Apples to Apples. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and that's a good one in terms of being, you know, sort of safe to play with younger kids, because, you know, it's got a theme that they're familiar with and that they probably have some background and knowledge of too.
Yeah, we've got that. There's a Disney Cranium. If you're familiar with the original game Cranium, where there's a lot of build this with Play-Doh or do this activity or, you know, whatever, Disney Cranium is the same kind of thing, but with Disney as a focus.
Okay. And see, again, that's an example of one that I think can adapt pretty well to, you know, Disney theming, just because in some ways, you know, Cranium is almost too broad, and giving it a focus helps.
Yeah, I can see that. It's something that, because you've narrowed it a little bit, or excuse me, quite a bit sometimes, it helps focus, especially for the younger kids, where I don't have a whole bunch of choices. I have to choose a Disney princess to do something with.
Exactly.
As opposed to choose a famous person.
Yeah,
you know.
And then you get paralysis by analysis.
Right. My kids did really well at Disney Scene It, which, granted, it's a DVD game. You know, you're putting it on the TV, et cetera, but it's still a game, a family game. And I realized exactly how many Disney films my kids had watched and how many of them I had not seen. Unfortunately, I think the Disney scene is like 4 or 5 years old. So it's not going to have anything really new on it.
Right.
You know, you're not going to have Frozen on there. You're not going to have, you know, the last, I think it has Toy Story, but I don't think it even has Toy Story 2 or Toy Story 3. You know, they mentioned like the Pixar stuff, but it's getting a little dated at this point, especially right. For a younger kid, that if you haven't exposed them to all the classics, they're kind of at a disadvantage. I realize the crowd we're talking to probably doesn't have that problem. I think we all have pretty extensive Disney libraries at this point. So, yeah.
All right. That's a good point. Anybody else have any other Disney focused suggestions? I mean, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There is a Nightmare Before Christmas version of Munchkin out there.
Oh, I need
Jackson
it.
Game.
it must be mine.
I have not played it, but I am a fan of the other Munchkin games, and I would imagine that a Nightmare Before Christmas theme is along the lines just made for.
There's a game similar to the Once Upon a Time game I mentioned earlier called Telltale. It's specifically Disney version. We have the Disney princess version. I think there's also a Pixar version. Basically, you're given cards that have an image on them. I just grabbed one here. It's got a picture of Diablo going after Gus. And you're given these cards, and you're telling a story based on them. So we've got pictures here from Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and Brave and the Princess and the Frog, and so you can tell any grand story you like
based on those. And then one last one, I know it counts now, Disney owns Star Wars.
Yeah.
The Star Wars Risk, the new version that just came out, that has Kylo Ren on the cover, it has nothing to do with Risk. And I think that's why it's not selling. I got mine for like half price of clearance. It is you're battling one person versus another. It's a two-player game. One's the Empire, one's the Rebels, and you're trying to blow up the Death Star. And you've got Darth Vader fighting Luke Skywalker on one side, and you've got the Rebels advancing on the shield generator on the other side. And you've got this big fleet in the middle fighting their way towards the Death Star. And it's a neat game that really... You know, it takes like that X-Wing game that was mentioned earlier. You kind of draw it on, makes it a little manageable for maybe younger players.
Interesting. You know, it sounds like it's a game that's almost, you know, suffering from choosing to use the Risk name as a marketing advantage.
Yeah, and it really... From what I'm told, there was a game that came out with the prequels called Queen's Gambit, and it's like a spiritual successor to that game, and that one is really well-regarded as a quality game that was just kind of overlooked at the time.
All right. Well, that's good to know. So there is a good Star Wars game out there, which we actually have now had references to a couple of them. Richard had suggested that miniatures game and the Star Wars Risk, so we've got a couple of good options in the Star Wars universe.
There's a Star Wars Carcassonne, too.
Oh, okay.
I think that one you're going to have to go to like Amazon and get, because the last time I looked for it, around November, December, because I was looking at it as a Christmas gift, I could only get online. It was a European import.
Yeah, it was only released overseas due to the licensing agreement with Hasbro, I think.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Carcassonne is one of those that's got different licensing in the United States and the rest of the world. All right. Well, you know, you've gotten a big pile here, I think, of really great game suggestions from us. You know, we'd love to hear from you, too. What kinds of things do you do for family game night? Do you enjoy them? Tell us about your family game night. Email us at podcast@dizdads.com. Visit our blog, dizdads.com. Tweet us at dizdadspodcast on Twitter. And participate in the discussions in our forums at boards.dizdads.com. Or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/dizdadspodcast. Until next time, I've been Aaron Rittmaster with Kevin Grossman.
Have fun, everyone.
Patrick Mines.
Like more games.
And Richard Grady.
The objective of the game is to win. The goal of the game is to have fun. Don't confuse them.